So when I look at Erin more carefully, she appears almost drunk. She is listing to one side. Nothing, don't worry. Are you tired? I ask. I am trying not to sound too hopeful. She nods.
Yes, I feel.
Her voice is slurred, and when she blinks, it is as if her facial muscles are moving in slow motion.
I feel really strange.
You must be exhausted, I say. I try to sound soothing, but my heart is beating faster with excitement. I put my untouched tea down on the table and wipe the dregs off my mouth, and I peer into Erin's cup. It is all but empty. Why don't you lie down?
I feel strange,
she says again, but her voice tails off. She lets me help her to lie horizontally on the sofa. Her body is heavy. I have no idea how many pills she has drunk. 3 or 4, maybe. I had 8 left, and I put them all into the kettle, trusting to the boiling water to dissolve them. I had no idea whether the heat would damage the chemicals, but I knew that Erin would be on the lookout for me tampering with her cup, and I was right. She watched me like a hawk as I put in the tea bag and poured out the water. The kettle was my only chance. Slipping the pills in one by one as I packed in the snow, trusting to the white snow to camouflage the white pills and the strong, unfamiliar taste of milkless tea to mask any odd taste. And, almost unbelievably, it seems to have worked. Erin has drunk the whole cup. Elliot had 5 ground up in his cup and it killed him. Erin is smaller and lighter, and she had about 1/2 the water, which means approximately 4 pills. 4 should be enough, assuming the heat of the water hasn't degraded the active ingredient. I will have to make sure of that. I can't take her silence for granted. But first, there is something I have to do, something quite urgent. With a sideways glance at Erin, lying sprawled on the sofa, drool coming out of the side of her mouth, I leave the living room. I run as quickly as I dare up the stairs to Elliot's room. The door is unlocked, and I open his phone again. Then I navigate to the text messaging app and Erin's message to Danny. SOS. Please send help. It's Liz. His reply is still there. Fuck, Erin, is that you? The precipice is in front of me, and expertly I swerve to avoid it. No, I type. I already told you. This is Liz. Erin has just confessed everything, and she's talking about killing herself. Please come now. And then I press send.
Erin. Snoop ID Little My. Listening to Offline. Snoop Scribers 10. I lie completely still, listening as Liz peers into my cup and then stands over me, breathing heavily. Then she seems to make up her mind, and I hear the soft sound of her socked feet retreating into the lobby and the creak as she begins to make her way up the stairs. I hold still for as long as I can bear, and then I sit upright, wincing at every rustle of fabric, every creak of the sofa springs. My arm and thigh are drenched with tea. But thank God Liz didn't seem to notice the spreading dampness on the sofa, only the empty cup. The pills were in the kettle. I suspected as soon as I tasted the first gulp of tea. There was a strange chemical acridity and a very faint sweetness that must have come from the sugar coating. And when I saw Liz putting the cup to her lips but only pretending to drink, I was certain of it. After that, I knew what I had to do. I had to pretend to drink too, taking advantage of the cover of darkness to slop the tea down my arm onto the sofa every time Liz turned away. I had no way of knowing how long the pills should take to work, but I had to gamble on Liz's ignorance too. She would have no way of knowing exactly what concentration I had taken or how quickly it would take effect. 10 minutes? 15? Whichever, she seemed to buy my performance of slipping into incoherence and then unconsciousness. Everything hinges now on whether she gave me enough to kill me. If she thinks she's given me a fatal dose, I'll be safe for a little while longer, at least until she comes back and notices I'm still breathing. But if she's only given me enough to knock me out, she'll be coming back very soon to finish me off. Will it be a pillow over the face, like Annie? Or a blow to the head, covered up as a fall down the stairs, or something completely different? Either way, I don't want to find out. I have to get away, and the sooner the better. Holding my breath, listening out for any sound from above, I hobble as swiftly and quietly as I can through the lobby to the door behind the stairs, the one that leads to the ski lockers. My own ski clothes are up in my room, and I can't risk trying to get to it, but my boots and skis are down in the storage lockers, and there should be enough spare clothing strewn around for me to put together an outfit that will at least keep me warm enough to ski in. I don't have nearly enough layers to survive a night in the open, and I can't walk on this ankle. I will have to get down to Saint-Antoine. But how? Skiing is the only option. And hope to God that the ski boot gives my ankle enough support to do it. The door to the locker room opens with the gentle click, and I slide through and close it with infinite care, my heart beating hard. It's very dark inside, the moonlight filtering faintly through a window almost completely blocked with snow, but my eyes are used to the darkness. And I'm able to pick out the vague shapes of jackets and ski pants hanging from pegs and boots drying on their heated poles. Hastily, my heart thumping in my throat, I yank on a pair of salopettes. It's only when I look down at myself that I realise they belonged to Annie. The thought that I'm literally stepping into a dead girl's clothes makes my stomach lurch with guilt. But I can't let myself get sentimental about this. Annie is gone. I can't save her. But maybe I can bring her killer to justice. As I struggle into someone's ski jacket, Elliot's, I think, judging by the size, I remember Liz's self-pitying whine as she told me about everything that had happened. And the thing is, I could almost have bought it. I don't know for sure what happened on that balcony, but I could believe that part of it. The frightened girl, the desperate shove. And I could believe too her cornered fear as she realised that Ava had her trapped and her terrified reaction. But Elliot? No. And most of all, Annie. Poor little Annie. Killed as she slept for nothing more than having seen something Liz didn't want her to see. Whatever Liz thinks about Ava and that unnamed investor and maybe even Elliot, Annie, out of everyone, didn't deserve this. She couldn't have. Only a monster could have killed Annie. It's Annie's face that I see before me now as I pull on wet ski socks and search around for mittens. Annie's face, speckled with the scarlet dots that give the lie to Liz's story. Because Liz says that she never wanted Annie to die. But I know that's not true. Annie must have fought.
She fought for every breath so hard that blood vessels broke in her skin. And Liz stood there and pressed the pillow down over her face all that long, long time. You have to want someone to die to kill them by suffocation. You have to want it a lot. It's Annie I'm thinking of as I open up my ski boot as wide as it will go. Annie, as I shove my foot inside, gritting my teeth as the pain in my ankle flares suddenly bright and hot. My breath is whimpering between my teeth, little sobs of pain coming in spite of the need for silence as I force my foot around the curve of the boot, hearing the bones in my feet click and grind in protest, feeling the swollen flesh squeezing against the hard plastic shell. But I have to do this. I have to. Annie. 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 And then with a crunch, my foot slides into place. I'm sweating and shaking with the pain, cold perspiration on my upper lip, but my foot is in. And miraculously, when I tried to stand, the pain isn't as bad as I thought it would be. The top of the boot is tight enough that I'm taking some of my weight on my shin rather than my ankle. I ratchet the boot clips as tight as I can, praying that the support will keep the joint stable for long enough to make it down the valley. If I have broken a bone, I may end up lame for good after this, but it's better than dead. Hastily, I shove my other foot into its boot and clip it up. And then I hear a noise from the stairs. My heart seems to stop. It's Liz, coming down the spiral staircase. For a second, I freeze. I have everything I need, but can I get out the back entrance? The ski door faces the same way as the swimming pool, and it will have been blocked by the avalanche. It opens inwards, at least I'm pretty certain it does. I press my hands to my temples, trying to remember, does it? If it opens outwards, I'm screwed regardless, but I'm sure it opens inwards. The question is whether I can dig my way out. And then my eyes go to the narrow little window above the ski lockers. It's letterbox-shaped, and although it's certainly long enough, it's probably only 12 inches high, less when you take into account the frame and the hinges, but it might be my best bet. Wincing at every sound, I climb up onto the wooden bench, and from there I lean over the ski lockers and open the window. A freezing blast scours my face, but I can see that the aperture isn't blocked. The snow obscuring the glass was just drifting flakes sticking to the pane. There is a drift almost up to the top of the lockers, but that will cushion my fall. I push my skis out first, one by one, listening as they tip into the soft snow with a flump. Then my poles. I pull on the borrowed mittens and grab a helmet at random from the rack. It fits, thank God, because I don't have time to pick and choose. And then I climb up to lie flat along the top of the lockers. They rock precariously, but only for a moment. I feel sick with nerves. From somewhere in the chalet, I hear a cry of surprise and then a shout of, "Erin! Erin, where are you?" Liz has discovered that I'm gone. I slide my legs out first. I am apprehensive about falling onto my bad ankle, but the alternative is dropping face first into the snow, and I don't fancy that either. Okay, I'm wearing a helmet, but the fall could still break my neck. Or if the drift is deep enough, I might plunge in vertically and suffocate before I could dig myself out. Feet first is safer. It's a squeeze, but I am managing. One boot sideways, my good leg first, then the other. The weight of the boot hanging off my bad ankle makes me gasp, but it's bearable, just. And then the locker room door opens.
I can't see anything at first because she's holding a torch, Elliot's phone, I think, and it's shining full in my face. But I can see the shape of a figure in the doorway. And I know who it is before she runs towards me with a snarl of anger that sounds more animal than human. I feel her hands grappling my arms, snatching, scratching, but her nails slide off the thick, smooth fabric, and there is nothing for her to catch hold of. I force my bum through the narrow gap, and then my body weight does the rest, dragging me after until I stick with a sickening jolt. For a split second, I can't work out what's happened. Has Liz shut the window? Has she grabbed my helmet? Then I realise, fuck, the helmet won't fit. I am hanging from my neck and I'm beginning to choke. The strap of the helmet is digging into my jaw and throat and I'm twisting like a fish on line. My mittened hands are at my neck, desperately trying to relieve the pressure of the strap. My feet are scrambling in the soft snow, frantic to get enough purchase to loosen the strain on my throat. My foot finds something, loses it again, and then finds it once more, just for a second, just long enough for me to unclip the strap. And then I fall, gasping and retching into a heap of soft snow and painful obstructions that, after a minute or two, I identify as my own skis and poles. There is no time to recover. Liz is yanking furiously at the helmet stuck in the aperture, trying to pull it free so that she can follow me. I expect her to shout or swear, but she doesn't, and somehow that's more terrifying. She says nothing. All I can hear is her grunting breath as she struggles to get the helmet out of the window. I have to get away before she pulls it free. I manage to stumble to my feet, sinking into the snow as I do, and using my skis as crutches, I stagger down the drift to the hard-packed snow. There, I take a split-second inventory. Mittens, yes. Skis, yes, both. And my poles. Scarf? Gone. It must have got pulled off with the helmet. And no hat, of course. I don't wear one now. The helmet is usually warm enough, but with the cold wind scouring my cheeks and face, I know I'm going to regret that. Still, there is nothing I can do. I can't turn back. I have to make it down to Saint Antoine somehow. I also have no avalanche pack. Fuck. Fuck. Which way? Slowly, painfully, I drag myself and my skis round to the side of the chalet and survey the piste. The long blue down into Saint Antoine is a wreck. There is no other way to describe it. I saw the top of the run when Danny and I made our way painfully back from the crushed funicula. The avalanche has dumped everything straight down it, huge boulders, lift poles, tree trunks. It's not just unskiable, it's impassable. And the path through the woods to the green run at Chum is totally inaccessible. The little copse has taken the full force of the avalanche and the trees are crushed and obliterated, buried under 100 tons of snow. But there is another way. It's called the Secret Valley, or at least that's what the English skiers call it. I don't think it has an official name. It's not a piste, just an unofficial route that you can just about ski if the conditions are right and if you're very good and you enjoy a challenge. Besides, piste gives completely the wrong impression anyway. It conjures up the image of a flat apron of snow with skiers crisscrossing each other with elegant turns. This is nothing like that. It's a long couloir between two sheer rock walls formed by a deep crevasse in the mountains. It needs a lot of snow to blanket the jagged boulders at the bottom. And even when conditions are good, the path at the bottom is so narrow that it can only take a single skier. And in places, if you reach out, you can touch both sides with your fingertips. If I can get down to it, I think it will be possible. Surely we've had enough snow to cover the worst of the jagged rocks, and it's out of the path of the main avalanche. But it's not a run, so much as an obstacle course. A twisting, turning slalom of boulders and tree trunks, hard enough to navigate in daylight, let alone with no light but the moon. And it's also very prone to mini avalanches. The snow builds up on the ridges above and breaks off without warning, deluging the skiers below. That's not the worst part, though. The worst part, the part that is making me hesitate, is that once you're down there, there is no way out. The sides of the crevasse rise higher and higher, and there is no way of getting a helicopter or a blood wagon down to someone trapped there. You just have to keep going until the chute spits you out among the trees at the top of the village. It is my best chance, and Liz very likely doesn't know about it. There's no way of finding it unless someone shows you the entrance. It's also my worst nightmare. But I have no choice. Holding my skis like a crutch, I begin to walk towards the head of the pass.
Liz. Snoop ID Anon 101. Listening to Offline. Snoop Scribers 1. Erin is missing. I almost don't notice. When I first walk into the living room, I am so sure she will be there that it doesn't even occur to me to check. But then something catches at the corner of my vision, something that is not quite as I left it. When I turn round, I see what has changed. The sofa is empty. For a moment, I just stand there, too puzzled to be worried. Has she woken up? Stumbled to the toilet? Erin? I shout. I go back into the lobby. I stare around the dark space, shining my torch up the stairs into the kitchen. Erin, where are you? She cannot have gone far. She drank enough of those pills to knock her out for a week. It is only when I go back into the living room that I see the dark spreading stain on the sofa. I touch it and sniff my fingers. It smells of tea. That is when I understand. She never drank the tea at all. I don't often swear, but I do when I see that. And I realise how she tricked me. I run. First to the door in the lobby, but the snow outside is untouched. She hasn't left the building by that route, at any rate. Then into the kitchen, but she is not there either. I'm halfway upstairs, ready to check the bedrooms, when I hear a noise. It is very faint, but it sounds like something falling onto the snow outside. It is coming from the back of the building, where the ski entrance is. I make my way back down to the lobby, and I open the door to the rear part of the building, where all the ski lockers are. It takes a moment for my eyes to get used to the darkness. And then I see something, or someone, moving at the far side of the room. It is Erin. She has climbed up on top of the ski lockers, and she is almost out of the window. I hurl myself across the locker room, scramble up the bench she has placed below the window, ignoring the twinges in my knee, and grab hold of her helmet, which is just about to disappear through the window. Then I realise why she is still there. The helmet won't fit through the gap. She is stuck. She is dangling from the helmet, horrible wheezing noises coming from her throat, kicking and kicking to try and get enough purchase on the snow to twist free. But before I have had time to figure out what to do, there is a sudden jerk, and the weight on the helmet falls away. The catch has broken, or she has unclipped herself, I'm not sure which. For a second, she lies, gasping and winded in the snow, and then she staggers to her feet, picks up her skis, and begins to hobble off toward the front of the chalet and the path that leads up to the funicular. I have to follow her, but the helmet is stuck in the frame, blocking it. It is only after a few minutes' fruitless tugging that I realise this is stupid. Erin has her skis and poles. She is clearly intending to ski to Saint-Antoine. And I have to stop her. I have to ski after her. Letting go of the helmet, I turn back to the room. I am wearing my jumpsuit already. All I need is boots, skis and mittens. Fast, before Erin gets away. I have two realisations to comfort me. First, in the soft snow, she won't be able to hide her tracks. I will be able to tell exactly which way she has gone. And second, I can ski faster than her. My wrenched knee is almost recovered, while her ankle has only been getting worse. I saw the way she hobbled back from the kitchen with the tea just a couple of hours ago. She couldn't put any real weight on it at all. I am pretty sure it is broken. And there is no way she can ski aggressively with a broken ankle. She will have to go slowly and carefully, and it will take her a long time to clamber over the broken up snow at the beginning of the Blue Piste. I saw what it looked like after the avalanche, a mess of rubble and debris. It will take a while to pick her way through that, even if it clears further down. I will be able to catch her up, if I act quickly. I make up my mind. I ram my feet into my boots and grab my skis and poles from the rack. My mittens are in the pocket of my jumpsuit, but my helmet, where is my helmet? It's missing from the locker, and after a few seconds I realise it's the one that Erin took, and it is wedged into the window. I have another go at trying to free it, but it's useless, and I cast around for an alternative before realising that I am wasting time. If Erin gets too much of a head start, even with her ankle, I won't catch her. Shoving Elliot's phone into my pocket, I hoist my skis onto my shoulder and clack-clack my way back along the corridor to the lobby, where I open the door into the snow and squeeze into the night. It is unbelievably cold outside, and I realise that however chilly the chalet was without heating, it was actually doing a pretty good job of protecting us from the elements. Now, out here, I don't know what the temperature is, but it can't be much over minus 20, maybe even less. The sky is clear, and the moon has that strange frost halo around it that you only get in extreme cold. Shivering, even in my warm jumpsuit, I clip my boots into my ski bindings and then straighten up, looking around for Erin's tracks. There they are, deep slashes of furrowed snow, dark against the moonlit white. But they are not leading up the track to the smashed-up Blue Piste. They are going the other way, into the forest. Erin, Snoop ID Little Mai, listening to Offline, Snoop Scribers 10. I had forgotten the beginning. Oh, God, the beginning. It's like a sheer wall of thick, soft snow, hemmed in with trees, studded with boulders, narrowing to a steep path just a few feet wide. And taking the first step is basically like jumping off the edge of a cliff and trusting to the snow to hold you. With two good legs, I could do this, Probably not elegantly, but I could do this. I'm rusty, but I've done enough off-piste skiing that I'm pretty confident in my technique. I know how to manage the deep, dragging snow, how to navigate the heavy turns, how to avoid plunging into drifts, and how to keep up momentum. I know all that, in theory. It's just that it's more than 3 years since I've skied off-piste. And I don't know if I can put any of it into practice with a broken ankle. My heart is in my mouth. But Liz will have seen my tracks in the snow. She'll be following after me. I have to do this. My downhill leg will be bearing most of my weight. I clip my ski boots into their bindings and then turn and angle myself so that my good ankle is down the slope. Then, with a sick feeling, I tip off. At first, it goes okay. I shush sideways in the fresh, fluffy snow, feeling like someone trying to swim with a duvet around their legs. But I'm heading rapidly towards the trees. I'm going to have to turn onto my bad leg. I manage an awkward kind of parallel turn, but I'd forgotten the physicality of skiing in thick drifts. The snow drags at my skis, nearly sending me over. But the real problem is the shock as I complete the turn and land on my bad leg. It sends prickles of pain up and down my spine, and I hastily turn back, trying to keep my good leg down the slope. But it's no good. I have to turn again to avoid a tree that looms out of the darkness, and this time my trailing ski catches in a drift, twisting my ankle with such excruciating force that I scream, the noise echoing off the steep walls of the valley. I land heavily on my bad leg, try to save myself with a flailing pole, and then I don't know what happens after that. All I know is that my leg gives way and my pole sinks, and I am falling, tumbling in the soft snow, my arms around my head to try to protect myself from the half-buried boulders that stud the slope. One ski is ripped off, my poles are wrenching at my wrists, I am upright and then head down, then sliding bum first, then I somersault and land with a bone-shaking jolt against a rock at the bottom of the pass. For a second, I can't do anything except lie there, gasping, winded, trying not to shriek from the pain pulsing through my leg. But I have to move. My spine makes a sound like crunching glass when I try to sit up, and I think I might throw up from the pain in my ankle. But I can see straight. I'm not concussed, at least I don't think I am. And when I drag myself to kneeling, the pain in my leg is intense, but it's still bearable. Just. I pull myself to standing using one pole, and then I rest for a moment, panting, shivering with shock and pain, forcing myself to breathe long and slow. It works, to a point. Then, when I'm calm enough, I shake the snow out of my hair and collar and take stock. I have one ski still on, and I'm holding one of my poles. The other is leaning against a rock on the far side of the gully, and I hobble across and grab it with hands that are still shaking with adrenaline. Okay, this is good. The other ski, though, where is it? I could ski with one pole, but I can't do anything with only one ski. If I can't find the missing ski, I'm screwed. And then I see it. The tip is sticking out of the snow a few feet up the cliff face I just fell down. I sigh, unclip my remaining ski, and crawl up the soft, shifting side of the crevasse to try to pull it out. But it's too deep. The bindings are stuck against something deep in the snow. And so I begin to dig with my mittened hands. And suddenly, out of nowhere, I am hit with a sickening, jolting flashback. The most vivid I've had since those first awful days when I woke up sweating every morning, fresh from a relived nightmare. Digging through the snow. Will's hair, the end of his ski, his cold, waxen face. Nausea rises in my throat. I push it away. I scrabble at the snow with my fingers. The snow in his eyelashes, the frozen tip of his nose. I want to sob, but I can't. I can't afford to make any more noise than I already have. Liz could be very near. The torn edge of his scarf, his blue lips. And then I have the ski. The bindings are clear of the snow and I can pull the rest of it out of the hole. Every part of me is shaking as I slide back down the slope to where I left my other ski. My teeth are chattering, my hands are trembling so hard that I can't get them through the loops in my poles, and I have to try to force my boots into the binding 6 or 7 times before I finally hear the answering click and feel the firmness of the clasp. When it's done, I just stand for a moment, resting wearily on my poles, giving my poor, quivering muscles a moment's respite. I'm honestly not sure if it's pain or exhaustion or the memory of Will's and Alex's deaths that's getting to me most. Maybe it's all three. But I can't allow myself to rest. I can't. There is a noise from the slope above me. It might be a marmot or just the snow I disturbed shifting and falling in my wake, but I can't afford to stay to find out. I push off with my poles and begin to ski cautiously into the mouth of the pass. Liz, Snoop ID Anon 101, listening to Offline, Snoop Scribers 1. Have I made a mistake? Erin's tracks stop at the top of what looks like a sheer drop into a gully below. The ravine itself is in deep shadow and I can't see the bottom. There could be anything down there. Jagged rocks, a mountain stream, a 1,000-foot drop. And yet, when I peer closer, I can see marks in the snow. Something, or maybe someone, has been down here. I can't believe that anything except for a mountain goat could make it down this slope in one piece. But as my eyes adjust to the shadows, I can see 2 deep grooves in the snow that look like someone sat back on their skis, catching their breath, before making a turn. I stand, hesitating, wondering what to do. Surely Erin hasn't skied down here with a broken ankle. Even for someone experienced in off-piste skiing, it looks like suicide. But her tracks definitely lead here. And they definitely stop here. Did she climb down? No. Whoever went down there was wearing skis.
Did she fall down? If she did, my problems may be solved.
Or is it some kind of elaborate trick? I pause for a moment, looking up and down the valley, but I can't see how it could be a ruse. There are only 2 sets of tracks leading up to this cliff edge, Erin's and mine, and neither of them leads away. And she didn't have enough time to do anything Sherlock Holmes-like. If she had retraced her own footprints to lay a false trail, I would have met her coming the other way. This must be a route down to Saint-Antoine. And somehow, Erin has managed to clamber down to it. Well, if she can do it, so can I. I'm definitely not skiing down there. I don't care whether Erin did. I have not done enough off-piste skiing to trust myself on anything this steep. Instead, I unclip my skis and, holding them in one hand, I sit on the edge of the drop and lower myself down into the soft snow to try to walk down the precipice. I know immediately that it was a mistake. Without skis to spread my weight, I sink deep, deep into the feathery drift. I scramble up, clawing for purchase, using my skis as a support. But as I struggle, the snow begins to shift underneath me. All of a sudden, it gives way, and we slither down the slope with terrifying speed. Me, my skis, and a slippery, moving mass of snow. At first, it is scary, but okay. I manage to stay upright, I can see where I am heading, and I am able to steer myself away from the trees, slow my descent. But then my boot catches on a rock. I can't stop myself. The weight of snow at my back is too great. I pitch forward. My skis are ripped from my hands. I am falling in a terrifying white blur of snow and rocks and skis. I have my arms wrapped around my head. I feel something hit my cheek and my shoulder crunches against something hard. I think I scream. I think I am dying. This isn't how I wanted to die. And then there is an almighty thump and I realise I have stopped moving. I am lying on my back, my head pointing down the slope, and there is hot blood coming from my cheek. My shoulder is pulsing with pain. I think I may have broken my collarbone. I try to pull myself to sitting, but the snow slithers treacherously beneath me, and I suppress a scream as I begin to fall again. But it grinds to a halt after just a few feet, and I lie, panting, sobbing with fear, before I realised that that last slide took me almost to the bottom of the slope. There is a path just a few feet below me. I can see one of my skis lying across it. Slowly, painfully, I swivel myself around so that my boots are down the slope and I let myself toboggan the last few feet. Then I am down. I am lying on the valley floor, practically crying with relief. Everything hurts. I can taste blood in my mouth. But I am down. And now that I am at the shadowy bottom of the ravine, I can see that I was right. And the realization gives me a little pulse of excitement that helps take my mind off my throbbing shoulder. Because I can see ski tracks in the snow leading away down the valley towards San Antoine. One set, pressed deep into the snow, marked with divots either side where the skier pulled themselves along with their poles. Erin was here. And if I hurry, I can catch her up.
Erin, Snoop ID Little Mai. Listening to Offline, Snoop Scribers 10.
This is harder than I could ever have believed. I remember doing this route in daylight, the sun sparkling from the frosted trees high up above, blazing back at us from the bright snow at our feet. I remember twisting, turning, laughing, leaping over half-buried boulders and dodging moguls. I cannot see any of those now. Traps loom out of the darkness, tree branches that swipe at my face, jagged projections rearing up without warning so that I have to swerve with sickening force, my ankles screaming with every jolt and twist. In a way, it helps that the gully is thick with fresh snow. It makes the skiing slow and arduous,
and I have no tracks to guide me, but it means I don't have to constantly try to slow myself down. When I came this way last time, the route was hard packed by skiers who had gone before me. I could see where they had twisted and turned, where they had misjudged an angle and wiped out against an unexpected tree or ploughed into a drift they didn't see coming. But at the same time, it made the going fast and furious, and with the track far too narrow for proper turns, most of my attention was taken up by trying to slow myself down to a safe pace. The thick snow makes this much less of an issue, but it gives me an urgent problem. Liz will be coming up behind, skiing in my tracks, where I have already pressed down the snow. She will be going much faster, and she has my tracks to guide her. I have to go faster. But if I do, I could end up killing myself. I give myself a shove with my poles, ski around a tight turn, my ankle screaming with protest, and then thump over what must be a concealed hummock in the snow. The shock of agony that runs up my leg makes me cry out, and I wobble and fall with a crash, thumping painfully into the rocky side of the couloir. For a few minutes, I just lie there, panting, hot tears running down my face. I cannot believe how much this hurts. I don't dare open up the ski boot to find out what's inside, but I can feel my whole leg throbbing with my pulse. I don't know if I will be able to ski again after this. I don't know if I will be able to walk again. But Liz has killed 3 people already. I have to keep going. I take a deep breath and go to push myself up on my pole. But I can't do it. My muscles are shaking so hard. I can't make myself do it. I can't force myself to put weight on my leg again. It makes my whole body tremble when I think of doing it. And then, from somewhere up in the gully, I hear sounds. There's a cry. The sound of someone who has just been hit in the face by an unexpected branch, maybe, followed by the rough scrape of skis being forced into an emergency snowplough. Liz is coming. And she is very close. I have to do this. I have to do this. I force my pole into the snow and heave myself upright, sweating and shaking, and then I push off.
Liz, Snoop ID Anon 101, listening to Offline, Snoop Scribers 1.
Where is she? Where is she?
The words keep repeating inside my head as I twist and turn, doggedly following in Erin's tracks. She cannot have been that far ahead of me, and her ankle was in a much worse state than my knee. I should have caught up with her by now, but I haven't. And that fact is making me not worried. Exactly, I'm not at that point yet, but definitely frustrated. Part of the frustration is because this is difficult skiing. More difficult than I'd imagined it would be. Even after my eyes have got used to the moonlit dimness at the bottom of the crevasse, I can't see very much except for Erin's ski tracks, and I have no choice but to follow them blindly as fast as I can, hoping that if she didn't mess up or wipe out, I won't either. There is a long, straight stretch coming up, and I give myself a push with my poles and hunch down, making my body more aerodynamic. I feel the wind in my face, and then I thump into a mini mogul invisible in the dim light. I feel air for a moment beneath my skis and then I slam back down, all my weight on my bad knee in a way that makes me catch my breath. I ought to slow down, recover my balance, but before I can do so, a tree branch comes out of nowhere, whipping me across the face so that I cry out. I go into an instant reflexive snowplow, the snow shushing beneath my skis, my heart thumping and grind to a halt. That was very close. If I hadn't been wearing goggles, that branch could have blinded me. As it is, it has opened the cut on my cheek again. I feel a ticklish trickle of hot blood run down my chin. I cannot afford to stop, though. I just have to be more careful. I push myself off again, peering into the darkness. I must be catching up. I must be. Then, just 100 meters further on, I hear it. The hissing sound of skis on snow. Someone up ahead is whisking round a tight turn, throwing up snow with the backs of their skis. My pulse quickens, and a race to catch up.
Erin, Snoop ID Little Mai. Listening to Offline, Snoop Scribers 10.
It is very dark now, at the bottom of the gully. The rocky walls rise up so high that no moonlight makes it down, and there are tall pines leaning over the top, their canopy blocking out the sky. But I don't dare slow down. This is the part of the run I remember the best. The part just before it shoots you out into the village. I must be almost there. Here is the long, sliding turn that takes you up the side of the couloir between two scraggly little saplings. I shoot up between them, trying to ignore the scream of my ankle and the trembling thumps of my heart, flooded with more adrenaline than it knows how to cope with. Then a swerve to the right, and then... Oh, fuck! I'm almost on it before I remember. What looks like a sheer rock wall and a breakneck left turn at a point in the path so narrow it's virtually impossible to slow yourself down. Its blackness looms out of the dark and I fling myself into a desperate sideways slide, my skis throwing up a glittering, hissing mist of crystals all around me. One ski catches on a rock and I almost lose control. My ankle is on fire with the pain, but I can't stop the frantic attempt to break. If I hit the turn at this speed, I won't just wipe out. Without a helmet, I will be dead. I'm turning, my skis almost perpendicular to the slope, and then I'm round. And almost immediately I hit a tree root, my ankle gives way, and this time I do wipe out. In a tumbling flurry of skis and snow. I have to get up. Liz is very near now. I can hear the hiss of her skis coming closer, the sound growing louder, funneled by the couloir. I have to get up. Only when I try to push myself to standing, I can't do it. My ankle won't bear my weight. I try... And my knee goes out from under me. I try again, sobbing this time, no longer caring about the noise I'm making, and collapse into the snow, weeping and swearing. She is almost here. She is coming. She is coming fast.
Liz. Snoop ID Anon 101. Listening to Offline, Snoop Scribers 1.
I am very close to Erin now. And then I hear it. A cry from up ahead and a clatter of skis. Yes, she has fallen. I feel a surge of triumph and it quickens my pace. This is going to be okay. I am going to catch her up. I don't think about what will happen when I do, time for that later. I crouch down again, I feel the wind in my face, This is it. I can do this. I thump over a hummock and I feel that same sense of exhilaration I did when I skied the Black Run. Only this is even better. I am skiing by pure instinct now, like a bird, flying in a slipstream, wheeling and turning with effortless skill. It's almost... And then it happens. A wall of rock looming out of the darkness just feet away. I think I scream. I'm not sure someone does. I try desperately to snowplow, but the path is too narrow and I'm not slowing down. I'm not slowing. I'm...
Erin. Snoop ID, Little Mai. Listening to Offline. Snoop Scribers, 10.
The sound when she hits is like nothing else I've ever heard. It is the sound of skis snapping and bones breaking. It's the sound of flesh hitting rock. It's wet and yielding, and it's hard as stone all at once. Was she wearing a helmet? Was she wearing a helmet? There is silence. Total, unbroken silence. Liz? I call shakily, but there is no answer. Not even a whimper. I try to stand, but I can't. Pain roars up and down my leg and my ankle gives way. I crouch on the snow, hunched on my side, trying not to throw up with the pain. I know I should leave her, but I can't do that either. I think of Danny's words before he left. I know you. Don't be starting up with that bleeding heart crap. Put yourself first. And I know he's right. But I can't do it. I can't leave her there to die. Like Alex. Like Will. Alone in the snow. I take off my poles. I unclip my ski boots from their bindings, and then I get onto my hands and knees and I begin to crawl back up the pass towards the turn.
Liz. Snoop ID Anon 101. Listening to Offline. Snoop Scribers 1. Erin. Snoop ID, Little Mai. Listening to Offline. Snoop Scribers, 10.
When I get there, the silence is complete. Liz is lying on her side at the foot of the cliff, a crumpled heap of red, white, and blue. The blue is her jumpsuit, the white is the snow. And the red is everywhere. She has been bleeding out over the snow, but it has stopped now. In the time it took me to crawl the 20 feet back up the pass, Liz has died. There is no breath coming from between her broken lips. When I put my fingers to the side of her neck, the skin is warm and slick with blood, but there is no pulse, not even a flicker. For a minute, I think about trying the impossible. Chest compressions, mouth to mouth. But when I turn her very gently onto her back, what I see makes me fall back, choked with horror. The left-hand side of her skull is smashed in like an egg, and there is brain matter on the snow. I feel faintness wash over me,
A great wave of revulsion and nausea that leaves me crouched and rocking on the ground, hugging my own knees. A tearing sound in my ears that I know must be my own sobs, but which sound like they are coming from someone else completely. I don't know how much time passes. I only know that two things shake me out of my catatonic despair. The first is that the sun is beginning to come up. The ravine is too deep for the rays to penetrate down here, but faint pink streaks of light are beginning to pattern the clouds above. And the second is that I can hear a buzzing. For a minute, I can't think what it is. It sounds like a phone, but I don't have one. My own phone is miles up in the mountains, back in Chalet Personnage, where the battery is dead and cold as all the bodies Liz has left scattered behind her. The buzzing stops, and then it starts again. And this time I realise, Liz, it's coming from Liz's pocket. Her jumpsuit is soaked with frozen blood, but I know I have to do this, and I reach across, my arms stiff with cold, and touch her hip. I pull open the zip, my mittened fingers numb and clumsy, and something slithers out onto the snow. Something bright as a jewel, with a jangling sound that makes tears start to my eyes. It's Elliot's phone. It is ringing. And the caller is Danny.
Erin. Snoop ID, Little Mai. Listening to The Pixies, Where Is My Mind? Snoopers 8, Snoop Scribers 151.
I don't know how long I lay there, side by side with Liz in the slushy puddle of her fast freezing blood. I only know that when the rescuers finally trekked up the gorge with their stretchers, I was almost hypothermic and I couldn't answer their questions. It was Danny who kept me going through those long hours, his voice in my ear talking, telling me that they were on their way, that I just had to hang on, not to give up. But when the rescue party finally arrived and prized the phone from my frozen mitten, slicked over with a sheen of bloody ice, he couldn't tell them what had happened either. It wasn't until 2 days later that I was finally able to piece it together for them, explain the abandoned chalet, the cryptic texts, and headlong flight down the treacherous couloir. But even I couldn't explain everything. Because how do you explain someone like Liz? To explain is to assign a reason for something, to make sense of behaviour, to justify it in a way. And I cannot, will not, justify what Liz did. I am discharged from hospital after a few days, but I can't go home. Partly because I don't want to. I am 22. I don't want to go back to my childhood bedroom with its posters of long-forgotten bands and its photographs, Will and Alex permanent ghosts hovering just out of the corner of my eye. But partly because I literally can't. The police haven't finished processing the crime scene that Personnage has become, and they've asked everyone concerned to remain in the area at least until their preliminary investigations are complete. We aren't suspects, at least I don't think we are, so there's nothing legally preventing us from returning to the UK. But it would look very bad to be impeding the investigation, and everyone knows that. It's clearly impossible to go back to the chalet as long as it's a crime scene, so I accept, with some relief, the police's offer of accommodation at a hotel in Saint-Antoine-le-Lac. It is only when I arrive, plastic bag of belongings in my hand, that I realise what this offer means. It's where they have put everyone. Topher, Rick, Miranda, Danny, Carl, Tiger, even Inigo. In fact, it's Inigo that I see first when I step through the door into the reception area and my mouth falls open. Inigo! I pull out my earbuds and he turns round from where he is inexpertly attempting to sort out internet access with the French-speaking receptionist. When he sees me, he flushes a deep, unflattering red, so dark it's almost purple. The flush doesn't suit him, and it tones down his extraordinary good looks into something approaching normality.